Thank you, brethren, for the opportunity once again to be with you. I am always deeply honored. I bring you greetings from the southernmost of the original 13 colonies, the fourth state in the Union, where we are privileged to work with good, kind, loving brothers and sisters in Christ who think that Pace Mild Picante Sauce is way too hot and that truly good barbecue is made from shredded pig served on a hamburger bun with vinegar. And we're praying that maybe through our influence they'll learn better and repent. But seriously, thank you to Stan, to Ken, to the elders here for the invitation. I have to make a confession. I was a little bit panicked when I got the assignment with its details, historical and geographical backgrounds of the Roman Empire. The first image that came to my mind were the six volumes of Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire that covers about 4,000 pages. The total duration of the Roman Empire, the Roman Kingdom, really, succeeded by the Roman Republic, which was then followed by the Roman Empire, spans more than 1,200 years. And our study this morning will cover about two-thirds of that history. So we've got to cover about 850 years of history in about 33 minutes now. I do not intend for this to be a dry, dusty recitation of dates and names. And so I hope that you won't engage it in that way. History and geography are both parts of the story of people. And it's the people involved in history and geography that make events and places significant. I understand now better than ever why young boys in the English public school system of the previous centuries, who grew up to be men like Winston Churchill, fell in love with the history of the Roman Empire, the Greeks before them, the Medo-Persians, the Babylonians. I understand better than ever why they loved ancient history, because they, particularly as citizens of the British Empire, saw a clear parallel in those ancient events to the grandeur and the events of their own empire. The existence and the preservation of Rome really served as a kind of real-time affirmation of the statement of Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44 that God rules in the kingdoms of men. It served as a confirmation of the prophecies, the statements given in Daniel chapter 4 that God puts who he wants in control and God would raise up his own kingdom in due time. The city of Rome was established about 753 B.C., I appreciated what someone said the other day about the difference between AD, BC, and BCE, and CE, and all of these acronyms. Several years ago, Brother Monty Jennings wrote a little bulletin article that just made the observation, whether you say BC and AD, or BCE and CE, really makes no difference because the focal point that divides the two is the same. They can't get away from the cross of Christ, even by changing the letters after the dates. And that point's well taken. But the city of Rome dates from about 753 B.C., about the same time that the Macedonian and Greek colonists invaded, really, parts of southern Italy and began to colonize that area. It's also the time in history when Israel, the northern kingdom, under the rulership of Jeroboam II, reached what would probably be the peak of their material wealth and power and corruption as well as a society. Assyria's conquest of that kingdom of Israel was just about one generation away when the city of Rome was founded. Let's begin by tracing Rome's rise from an insignificant little backwater village, really, to the capital of the entire known world. To go from a minor city to a majestic imperial capital was a journey that took centuries. Rome was originally a kingdom, a city-state, really. It was on the shores of Lake Alba. The original Romans seem to have come from the other side of the lake, basically, the area where the papal retreat, Castel Gandolfo, now is located, a tourist area. In time, it moved from kingdom status to a republic. What moved it? The Romans adopted much of the philosophy of governance, of education, of civic polity that originated in Greece. In fact, we could almost say that they adopted Greek culture and religion and philosophy on a wholesale basis. Because after all, in the New Testament, what was the common language of the Roman Empire? It wasn't Latin, friends. It was Greek. Legend says the city was named for Romulus. Now you can look up Romulus and Remus and learn about the twin brothers who were suckled by a wolf and so forth. Whether Romulus was an actual historical person is maybe open to some debate, but he is commonly considered to be the first king of the city. He's later known in Roman history as Quirinus, not to be confused with Quirinius, who's mentioned in Luke chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. The image and the legend of Quirinus or Romulus in the Roman mind came to symbolize not just the individual whom they deified and considered as a god, but it came to symbolize a representation of the whole state and the people as well. It was the embodiment of what Rome represented. Now, while Sennacherib of Assyria was still the dominant world ruler at this point in time, the city of Rome began to grow and gained a measure of security and stability. And the last of her kings, they had about five, a fellow named Tarquin the Proud, Lucius Tarquinus Superbus. Tarquin was then dethroned. He was an arrogant man, a powerful man, but he was eventually dethroned and exiled because the Romans elected a Senate. And in the year 509, the Senate declared Rome a republic. You can see in this change the encroaching influence of Greek culture and thought. It was during the early years of the Republic that the city of Rome really began to expand beyond just their own little sphere of influence. They began to systematically try to conquer their neighboring cities and states. This is the era of the Etruscan civilization in Italy, of the Volsci peoples. And those folks, those peoples, those cultures were slowly but surely assimilated into the Roman Republic. One of the keys to Rome's success in uniting their neighbors and these peoples was that when they conquered them, they assimilated them. They brought them in as part of their society. They did not, at this point in their history, enslave them and destroy their cities. Rather, they incorporated them into Roman society. And those who served from these client cities as Roman soldiers then were rewarded with Roman citizenship when they retired and usually were given land grants, initially in the environs of Rome proper, but ultimately in conquered territories. And that just served to spread Roman influence, Roman power, Roman philosophy of government and conquest to those areas. Now, the Medo-Persian alliance began to unravel, really, about the year 408. We're going to jump across into Asia for a moment. The Medo-Persian alliance begins to unravel. The Medes are trying to break free of Persian domination. You'll remember the imagery there of the one horn being greater than the other, and there's more dominance on one side than the other. This coalition government was not destined to last indefinitely. At that same time, approximately, Rome suffered invasion. Rome suffered... pardon me. Forgive me if I stop and bark like a seal periodically. It's seasonal allergies. But they were invaded by wild people, Gauls, really, the ancestors of modern Frenchmen and Germans. And they were then... the city was destroyed about the year 390. They sacked Rome, but then they didn't stay. They took what they wanted and left. Rome was rebuilt, and about 15 years later, in 377 BC, they built a wall around the city to protect themselves. Now, there's more information in the manuscript about that, about subsequent efforts to invade, Horatio at the gates and so forth, Horatio at the bridge. But at this same time, you have Greek philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, who are the dominant intellectual lights of the age. Xenophon, if you've read much of Greek history, Xenophon is the primary Greek historian. And this is also the era when Alexander the Great is born. Alexander would be a student of Aristotle, as we've already heard, until he's 16 years old. At about age 20... he takes his father's place as king. In 13 years, he will build an empire that spans much of the known world. Well, what does that have to do with Rome? Simply this. The one direction Alexander did not go in conquest was west. He reached out north from Macedonia, south into what in New Testament times was Achaia, across the sea into modern-day Turkey, all the way to India, down into Egypt, as far as Ethiopia. He built a massive empire, but he didn't ever go west. There are some geographic reasons for that, the high mountains and the sea and so forth. But there's also a prophetic or a biblical reason for that. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 4, Daniel is told that he'll go north and east and south, but not west. What's west? Rome. And God, even in the days of Alexander, is preparing Rome to serve his purpose for the coming of the Christ. Now, Alexander was motivated by the conviction that the rest of the world needed Greek government and culture and philosophy and so forth. He was truly an apostle of all things Greek. It was his influence in Palestine that led to the division between the Sadducees and the Pharisees in many ways, because the Sadducees embraced Hellenistic culture. Centuries later, Julius Caesar would find a ready ally in a converted Sadducee, Antipater, the father of Herod the Great, who would embrace Julius Caesar against Pompey because of his loyalty, his affinity for Hellenistic or Greek culture. He saw in Julius Caesar the future, and it paid off in a big way for him and his family. Now, while the Persians, as Brother Shaul noted the other day, kind of led the way in ancient road building in the ancient world, the Romans learned their lessons very well. They built aqueducts, the Appian Aqueduct, the Appian Way, that spanned from Rome down to Brindisi, and the heel of the Italian boot was a military highway that for its day had no equal. It cut through mountains, it crossed lakes, a 19-mile stone causeway crossed the Pontine Marshes, all so that the Roman army could expand the Republic's influence. It's interesting to notice in the book of Acts, you come down to chapter 28 and verse 13, the Apostle Paul traveled part of that fabled highway while he was en route to Rome. Alexander Alexander the Great, that is, died in 323. His death precipitated 4 decades of conflict between his would-be successors. And what stands out as far as Rome is concerned is that Rome had no significant part in that internecine strife. They spent their energies building and consolidating their own influence in Italy, like the Greeks. The Roman Republic concentrated on spreading itself, spreading its influence wherever it could. And it's at this point, now that Alexander is out of the way and these folks are over here fighting amongst themselves, at this point, the Roman Republic begins to expand very aggressively, begins to become really militaristic. It's at this point that they go to war with the Carthaginians, the Punic Wars, in which they faced Hannibal. This is when Hannibal crosses the Alps through Spain into France with elephants and comes down through northern Italy to try to invade Rome. He almost succeeded. The Punic Wars with the Carthaginians from North Africa took a toll on the Roman Republic. They cost a lot. Time, money, men. But they also welded the varied conquered peoples that comprised the Roman Republic into one people. Rome would eventually repulse Hannibal and destroy both Corinth in Greece and Carthage in North Africa. They would, for the first time really on a large scale, enslave the populations of those cities. They hadn't really been big into that up to this point. And now that we're in the 2nd century BC, they bring Greece, Macedonia, and Achaia into their control. They become provinces of the Roman Republic in 147 BC. Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, follows about 15 years later, 133. But the seeds of failure for the Roman Republic, not the empire, but the Republic, were planted during this time because of civil wars among the competing politicians. It's an era of rebellion against Rome's inequalities. You have two very disparate classes, the patricians on one side, the plebeians on the other. You have the privileged class and you have the working class. Now, over the years, things have eased somewhat. They can intermarry. There are leaders elected from the plebeian, the working class as well. But nevertheless, the Senate, the patrician class, the ruling class, are conservative and protective of their own values. And so at this point in their history, rebellion begins to break out here and here and there throughout the empire. In 71 BC, Spartacus leads a revolt of gladiators and slaves, only to be crushed by names that become familiar to us now, Pompey and Crassus, who served with Julius Caesar in the first triumvirate. Caesar himself was involved in some of these conflicts, and eventually they brought him into conflict with Pompey and precipitated a civil war that he was largely responsible for, that is Caesar. He defeated Pompey and his forces in 49 BC and then was voted dictatorial power. He was made dictator by the Roman Senate. That was the death knell to the Roman Republic. That's where Caesar and Antipater, the father of Herod the Great, come together. Antipater becomes the Roman procurator of Judea. He had been a kind of power broker in the area and had first been an ally of Pompey and then switched his alliance to Caesar when it became expedient. Josephus tells us that he was a very able administrator, that he was a very effective politician and bureaucrat. But it's his son, Herod, who marries a Hasmonean princess, who marries a Jewish princess of sorts. It's Herod who will become the focal point of that relationship, because Herod becomes Herod the Great. He has now a familial claim to the Jewish throne. But at this point, Caesar dies. And with him, the Roman Republic fails. Caesar's stepson or designated heir, he was actually a great nephew of Caesar, Octavian, becomes the first emperor of Rome. He's known to us as Caesar Augustus, Luke chapter 2 and verse 1. Caesar the Great, the August. He is deified by the Romans. They worship him. Julius Caesar is deified by the Romans. He is known in Roman history from that point forward as Julius Divinus, the god Julius. And Augustus ruled at the time of the birth of Jesus. He annexed Judea in 6 BC. That's where Jesus was born, about 2 years later, about 4 BC. Just before the death of Herod the Great. Now, Augustus is going to die shortly while Jesus is still an infant. He will be succeeded by Tiberius, his son by adoption, and Tiberius will rule the empire throughout the balance of the life of Jesus on earth. He'll rule until 37 AD. Jesus the Christ grows to manhood, fulfills his ministry, dies a sacrificial death on the cross, is buried, resurrected, and ascends back to the Father, all during the reign of Tiberius. Now, historically, Tiberius is followed by Caligula, who was nuts, reigned for about 4 years. Caligula was commonly thought, even in his own time, to be mad, and he was assassinated by some of his own soldiers. He was succeeded by Claudius, who expelled all the Jews from Rome, Acts chapter 18 and verse 2. That included many Christians, because at that point in history, the Romans didn't see any difference between Christian Jews and just ordinary Jews. That leads to Paul meeting Aquila and Priscilla at Corinth. Nero then follows Claudius when Claudius is probably poisoned by his wife, so that Nero can become the emperor. What do we know about Nero? Oh, he's the guy who fiddled while Rome burned. Well, that's apocryphal. That didn't happen. They didn't have violins in those days. But Nero was the first emperor to persecute Christians. He commits suicide in 68 AD. There was a year of turmoil after that. And the Jews in Judea, the zealots, the assassins, pick that moment to rebel. They're thinking and remembering the success of the Maccabees against Antiochus, and we'll talk about him in a moment. And they're fired, their imaginations are fired with thoughts of casting off the hated Roman overlords. And Vespasian, who is the general of the 10th Roman Legion and has charge of Roman military might in that part of the empire, Vespasian begins what we'd call a pacification effort later that year, into the year 69. Things are going well for him. He's making progress toward Jerusalem, but there's still upheaval in Rome, and next thing you know, he is chosen emperor by acclaim. Now, he's got a rival for the throne, Vitellius, so he leaves his Roman legions in the charge of his son, Titus, goes back to Rome, secures his throne, and Titus now lays siege to Jerusalem in March of 70 AD. 2 months later, the outer walls are broken down. 3 months after that, the city is conquered, the temple is burned. Almost the entire city of Jerusalem was razed by the Roman army. Only a few towers and buildings were left for use by the garrison that would be stationed there from then on. In 79, 9 years later, Vespasian dies, and Titus becomes the first actual biological son of an emperor to succeed his own father as the emperor of Rome. That's about two-thirds of Roman history in a very, very, very small nutshell as it affects Daniel and the Bible generally. Let's talk about religion as it affects Rome and Daniel and the Bible. In the time that Daniel lived, Rome had very little to do with the world Daniel was living in. Daniel may not have known anything about Rome and her kings in his own lifetime. They were small, they were insignificant, they were a backwater hamlet by comparison to the empire that he lived in. But they were rising. And that's why they're singled out in prophecy in the book of Daniel. From the beginning, Roman religion was basically synthetic. It reflected their political philosophy of integration. They would glom onto a people, and they would just bring the people along with their religions in and just incorporate them to benefit the empire, basically. As they expanded, they tended to just vacuum up and adopt the religions of whatever peoples they conquered. Now, they brought their own religion with them as well. It probably started out as a kind of an agrarian fertility religion, but it wasn't long before Romulus or Quirinus was deified and began to represent the whole concept of Rome as a nation, as a state, as a kingdom, ultimately as a republic and an empire. They brought that with them, and they just wanted to add all of this together. In the polytheistic world they lived in, that wasn't a problem for most of the people that they conquered. And as they grew, their perception of their own gods grew as well. Their idea of their greatness and their power grew. It was pretty typical of ancient empires. Except during the very brief years of Caligula's rule, it's significant that Rome didn't really make any effort to supplant the religions of her conquered peoples. Caligula, who was nuts, decided that particularly with the Jews, but with the empire generally, particularly with the Jews though, he wanted to stamp out their religion and supplant it with the worship of Roman religion. And he was going to have a standard, a statue, an idol basically erected in the temple in Jerusalem. Well, he died before that could come to pass. That was a good thing for the Jews of that era. Caligula was crazy enough, he would have obliterated Jerusalem had they resisted him. But he died, and that took care of that problem. Most of Rome's indigenous religions show the strong influence of Greek religion and culture. When you were in grade school, you probably studied about the Greek and Roman pantheons, and you may remember that there is a lot of overlap between them. How that Zeus in Greece was Jupiter in Roman religion, and so forth. That was just a token or a symbol, as it were, of how inclusive they were on a general level. The Roman people saw their military conflicts as battles between their own gods and their neighboring gods. They were very parochial in their religion, in a sense, just like many ancient peoples were. Worship of the emperors, as they were then deified in the century leading up to the time of Christ, and in the first century, worship of Roman emperors then became really little more than a ritual on a practical level. It was really more of a test of citizenship, like a loyalty oath, than it was any religious expression of faith. But it was the religion of the land. There were two kinds of religion in the Roman Empire. There were licitae, or licensed religions, authorized, legal, and there were foreign or unlicensed, illicit religions. Generally speaking, the authorities didn't interfere with the unlicensed religions. They didn't care about them. They had bigger fish to fry. The only thing that would bring them into play and bring an exercise of law into play was if those religions being practiced disturbed the peace. Even after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, Judaism was not outlawed. Judaism was not persecuted as a religious group in the Roman Empire because it generally didn't disturb the peace. The church was originally or initially seen by the Romans as just another outgrowth of Judaism in spite of its reaching out to the Gentile community. Eventually, though, antipathy sprang up between the empire, the Roman authorities, and the church. Now, Pilate, having Jesus on trial, said, "I find no crime in him." And even when Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world," Pilate understood this man's identity as a king doesn't pose a threat to my emperor. It's not a problem. But as the church grew and expanded the concept of a kingdom into the empire, many Romans, and especially Romans in government, just couldn't wrap their heads around the idea that these Christians could be part of a kingdom that was not in direct competition politically and militarily and economically with Rome. They couldn't get the idea of a spiritual kingdom. But then also, there was another aspect of the kingdom that they found extremely offensive, and that is that it was inclusively exclusive. And what we mean by that is the gospel was an assault on the sensibilities of Romans because they were accustomed to just vacuuming up and including everybody and incorporating them wholesale into their empire and just sort of having a free flow of ideas, and we'll all just agree about everything. And the gospel said, no, you take all of these religions, all of these idols, all of these forms of worship, set them aside, cast them aside. This is the Messiah. Jesus is the Son of God. And even though the church benefited from a very open kind of a laissez-faire attitude in the beginning, by the time of Domitian at the end of the first century, systematic persecution began because the church was already well established with second and third generation Christians. How did they get there? Well, very briefly, two words, Pax Romana, the Roman peace. In many ways, those words are synonymous with Paul's words in Galatians 4, verse 4, the fullness of time. The Roman influence brought the entire Mediterranean coast, actually from the Atlantic coast of Portugal all the way around the entire Mediterranean to the Atlantic coast of North Africa, under one rule, one body of laws, one army enforcing those laws, enforcing peace. Building roads, building bridges, building aqueducts, building infrastructure that enabled commerce and trade and travel. Paul and his companions could actually travel in relative safety through most of the empire because of the influence of the Roman army and Roman law. The benefit of citizenship was a blessing without equal in the ancient world. Citizens had a range of rights and privileges that subjects explicitly did not. There are two Christians in the New Testament that we know were Roman citizens, Paul and Silas. And it's significant that they did not hesitate to take advantage of the benefits of their Roman citizenship. Well, let's put this all together just very, very briefly then. How do we summarize it? Daniel chapter 2, verses 42 and 43 foretells the coming of the Roman Empire in that image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. The legs, the feet of iron and iron mingled with clay, the diversity of beliefs and values in Rome's empire would contribute to the eventual downfall of that empire. By contrast, the vision in verse 44, a kingdom ordained, established by the Almighty God, is the vision of a kingdom that cannot be fractured, that has no faults inherent in it, that will experience no upheaval, that leads to a change of government or administration. The establishment of that heavenly kingdom also serves as the temporal marker to define the fulfillment, the end of the earthly kingdom's power and existence. There's more in the book. Let me encourage you to take a look at that. I hope that this has not been just a, as we remember, a dull history lesson. But it is a fascinating, fascinating story inspired by the God of heaven. Thank you.